Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and we're going to have a very thoughtful time during the first part of the program today because we're going to be talking about a subject matter that most people do not even want to get close to. What is it? It's the death of a loved one. But we're especially going to be talking about the death of children. Now, you may think this is rather strange, but it has been my experience as a minister and as a counselor that if you cannot talk about life when it happens, and death is going to affect all of us at one time or another, you are going to find that life is filled with so much pain and so much suffering. And that's what two women that are coming on the air with us today, Suzanne Redfern and Suzanne K. Gilbert, these two ladies have put together a book that I think is just outstanding. It's called The Grieving Garden, Living with the Death of a Child. And 22 parents contributed to this book about their personal experiences. Suzanne and Susan, I welcome both of you to the show.
Thank you very much, Donna.
Now, you each are going to have to tell your own story, but, and I know that that is part of what evolved the two of you coming together. And each of you had your own particular experience with the death of a child. When you went through your experiences, I would like for you each individually, and Suzanne Redfern, why don't you share yours first?
What happened
with your daughter, Mimi?
Well, it will be 9 years ago that my daughter, Mimi, died of lung cancer. She was 32 years old and had been diagnosed about 8 months previously, gone through surgery, and then there was a recurrence and went through the usual chemotherapy, and which was unsuccessful. So in December of 1999, she died. And at that time, I found myself extraordinarily isolated, even though friends did reach out, certainly. But I felt as if I were the only person who had ever experienced anything like this. And I couldn't find anything in the written work that was out that satisfied my huge need to just be in the company of someone who knew what I was going through.
Now, Susan Gilbert, your story, your daughter.
Thank you.
What happened?
Well, my daughter Amanda was 18, almost 19, and she was a freshman at UCLA. She was on the UCLA debate team. Amanda was a wonderful debater. And as the team was coming back from a tournament, the driver lost control of the van in which they were driving, and the van rolled over. Amanda was a passenger. It was unimaginable. Amanda had so much life and was such a happy person. It was unimaginable to think that, that she could possibly be gone. And, I remember, when the policeman came to the door after he left thinking, this is the very worst thing that can happen in life, and I'm just going to have to make my mind up that I'm going to try to survive it. It didn't seem that I didn't feel like I could, but I did make that decision right then.
I want my audience to know a little bit about both of you ladies. Suzanne Gilbert, who was just speaking, she attended the University of Chicago. She got her Bachelor of Science from New York University, and then she ended up moving to San Francisco and went into school to get her counseling psychology degree. They have been involved with she and her husband have been involved with the San Francisco homeless, and she is very active in many different activities. Suzanne Redfern comes from a small farming town in the San Joaquin Valley. She graduated with a BA in political science from Stanford University, and she is the mother of three children, and currently she's the president of her father's company, Redfern Ranchers, and she lives in Palo Alto. Ladies, how did the two of you meet? What brought you together? Because I am sure after this kind of a tragedy in the family, the writing a book was the last thing in the world that you were really going to be interested in. How did the two of you meet?
Well, interestingly, through our mutual hairdresser. This is Sue speaking. Suzanne had developed the concept for the book and had put together a series of 24 topics that she was hoping to recruit bereaved parents to address. And so she had already developed the concept for the book, and I was recruited as one of those parents who would contribute. But after we got together, Suzanne very kindly invited me to join her as co-author of the project. So our hairdresser does more than do our hair.
Isn't that amazing? Hairdressers have this networking capacity that's just incredible. Susan, with you, what prompted you to start doing an outline? Was this part of your healing process?
Yes, it certainly was, and it was astounding how it came together it was probably within the first year after Mimi died, and once the concept arrived in my mind of what sort of book I wanted to do, the 24 questions came almost unbidden. I sat at my computer and just let them flow. And I think it was because, I don't try to make it too otherworldly here, but I think it was because these were the issues that had come to me that I had faced and had questions about during the previous year or so. I had been fortunate enough to plug into a nonprofit here in Palo Alto, a grief support center, that gave me a volunteer peer grief counselor who came to my house every week for a whole year. And we sat in my garden whenever the weather permitted, hence the grieving garden,
mm-hmm.
and talked about her son, Nick, who had died several years previously, and about my Mimi, and about our grief. And so these issues formed with our conversations, and I felt a great need to explore them further and perhaps to help other parents as they had to face the same sorts of issues.
I like the description you had right in the front part of your book. You said, when the day was mild, we'd take our teacups outside to my small brick patio fringed with camellias and scented with orange blossoms. I came to think of this comforting place as my grieving garden, which is what you just described. It became a refuge in which good companionship and shared emotions calmed my raw nerves, eased my loneliness, and relieved my fears. I think that that is so real. And when we have, I think one of the things that hits people is when they do have a child that dies, whether it's from a disease, an accident, there's so many different ways that it can occur, there is that tremendous sense of helplessness. And often I have heard people say the young shouldn't die before their parents. And there's all of this, I call it layering, that affects belief systems. And I'd like each of you, Suzanne, why don't you address it? When your daughter died, there's the word loneliness that comes out. And you have so many wonderful parents that contributed to this, and we'll talk about some of them. But with the two of you, because of your personal experiences, what for you did you feel that you needed? And everybody's different when something like this happens. For you, what was the biggest step for you to overcome? I know I'm asking a few questions here, but try to address them if you can.
I think my biggest void in my life was the feeling that this was a subject that was not an experience, it was not beyond the human experience, that it is a part of life. And so much of our culture is centered upon really a denial of death in general,
mm-hmm.
and this death in particular, that when the subject would come up with strangers or even with friends, people make every effort to change the subject as quickly as possible. People avoided talking about my daughter. I just wanted to be able to be in the experience and not feel as if I were a pariah in some ways, an outcast. So it was the linking with other human beings and in just the basic human ways without fear.
And many times, I'd like to ask you a personal question. Did you find many times you just wanted to talk, you really didn't want anybody's opinion, you just wanted to be able to speak out about the pain, maybe even cry? I mean, it's...
Certainly. Oh, certainly. I think what all of our contributors who address these issues agree on is that advice is useless.
Mm-hmm.
People who try to find rationalizations or answers or religious sort of bromides, none of that does anything. But the simple reaching out from another human being is provides comfort like nothing else will.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's true. Suzanne, what would your response be?
Well, I share a lot of what Suzanne said. There is an enormous void and enormous feelings of isolation, no matter how many people you might have in your life. Going to the supermarket was torture. First of all, the products that might remind me of my daughter, you know,
mm-hmm.
her yogurt brand or whatever was devastating. But even people I knew, not close friends, but people I knew would duck down another aisle. They didn't know what to say or what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, people will cross the street. And I think I've heard that from many bereaved parents. It's just like a knife in your heart when you see, people just won't even say hello to you. And you understand that they just don't know what to say, and you can empathize with them. But you're really in a place where it's hard to take.
Mm-hmm. It's very hard. And I think, again, culturally, we have whitewashed so many things. And I think that's one element of reality that 9/11 brought to the forefront. And you have someone in your book that lost someone in that event. And I'd like for you to tell about that story. But it is a reality. There is not anyone that is not going to be touched by death.
Mm-hmm.
And it is something I think your book, The Grieving Garden, brings to the forefront, and each of your contributors has a very special story to tell. You have a poem in here by Lucille Clifton. It says, "The angels have no wings. They come to you wearing their own clothes. They have learned to love you and will keep coming unless you insist on wings." That's quite a deep thought that one would need to reflect upon, and I think Lucille was trying to convey a very special message there. You had a woman, Inez Asensio.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us her story.
Well, Inez is a Latin American, Cuban American woman who grew up in the United States in the East and became a psychologist. And was pregnant with her first child, and just a day or two before that child was to be delivered, she died in utero. And Inez was given the choice in a sensitive hospital whether to give birth to the child or to have a cesarean delivery, and she chose to give birth. And it was a very difficult birth because there was no sense on the medical team, of course, of concern about the baby. The baby was already gone.
Mm-hmm.
So she gave birth to the child and brings, I think, a very lovely sense of the Latin American response to death, which is healthier than most of the rest of us who contributed, I think, where there's a wake. She was allowed to hold the baby at the time of birth and then took her home, and friends and family came and visited. And it was an opportunity for them to bond with a child whom they never would know beyond this moment.
Mm-hmm. She wrote a beautiful poem, Just a Heartbeat. "When the doctor told us I have bad news, there's no longer a heartbeat, I cried. I felt devastated and alone. You left. I remember your father rubbing my stomach and crying. When the doctor came back, she hugged me. I remember hearing her heart beating strong and steady. It soothed me. And then I thought, my heartbeat must have soothed you while yours still beat within me. And I felt better." I think that you present so many different pictures. And someone listening to the show may think, oh, this is so morbid. Why do you talk about it? Because I think when we can see that there are ways that we can deal with this, and I liked what you said about Inez and the family and how they had a wake. They had a ceremony, if you will, that allowed for a healing. And I think that that's very important. I've known people who have, perhaps there's been a horrible accident on a site, they decide they want to put flowers. Look at how people responded to, you know, Princess Diana's death, the flowers, the outpouring, the caring. And this has happened so many times, and it's important. It's important to be able to do that, because the grief is for us. We're the ones that are left behind. I'll use that terminology.
Mm-hmm.
And so often that kind of feeling, it is like a release. It's as if it can create a sense of peace. You don't forget, but it's as if there's a type of closure. Let's talk about, for a moment, the questions that come up. You mentioned it a little bit earlier, where there are no answers many times. Things can happen. And people go through a very, very difficult time. You used a counselor. And what would you recommend for someone when they're going through this, if you feel like someone needs counseling? How would you approach them?
Well, I was a business executive, and then I got a degree in clinical psych. And I did that after Amanda died, and that was my way of holding myself together. I could no longer fulfill the responsibilities of being vice president of a major corporation. So, you know, I knew that psychology, most interesting thing in the world to me, and that's the condition under which I got my graduate degree in psych. I did a few internships, but it was not my intention to practice. I am, however, going to be a counselor at a peer counselor with CARA, the grief support organization that Suzanne mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
What I think, to answer your question more broadly, I think that what we have found among the 22 people represented in our book, including us, is that you're most at home and most comfortable in the company of people who share your experience.
Mm-hmm.
So for any bereaved parent, somebody who's recently lost a child, probably the place they'll be most comfortable is with people who've also had that experience.
Frequently, when something like this happens in a family, a couple separate. They'll get a divorce because each person is going through their own kind of grieving process, and often the communication system disappears because they don't know how to relate to each other. How do you feel this is something that can be addressed? What is some of the experiences that some of the people in your book have done to deal with this? Because I know Inez's husband went through a tremendous amount of grieving, and she was very sensitive to his feelings. But sometimes the grief is very, very deep. How would you recommend someone deal with that?
Well, I believe in the first place is to recognize right up front that the two of you are not going to grieve in the same way. One of our contributors, who's Ann Logan, writes on this subject, if I could read shortly from her section. After some time, Mark and I understood that while we felt the same loss, we grieved in different fashions. In our culture, men are expected to be providers, doers, to be strong, to fix what's broken. Women are perceived as emotional, nurturing, social. Mark could not bear to see me weeping. He felt helpless. There was no way to fix my sadness. I believe that he also feared becoming swept away by his own emotions, to lose control, to fall into the abyss of sadness and never emerge. On the other hand, I knew he had no answers. I just wanted him to cry with me, to rail at the stars. So I felt abandoned. I don't think this is an atypical situation within a marriage. We found also that in some marriages, one partner would, after some years, be readier to get on with life in a more normal way,
mm-hmm.
and the other not yet. It isn't something that necessarily gets solved in the short term.
Mm-hmm.
unusually in our among our 22 parents, in only one case was there a divorce immediately soon after the death of the child. Those that were married somehow did manage to find their way through their grief together.
Working with Anger is the title of one section. You have many, many parts to your book, which I think are very powerful. Anger is a significant part. I have a very, very dear friend whose son was just the day after graduating from high school, going to be going to college, got in a motorcycle, ended up being in a horrific accident, and was killed. It took her 11 years to get through that. It was a long, long journey. She battled with alcoholism. She wasn't ever a drinker, but it happened afterwards. There was a lot of anger, tremendous, tremendous anger. How can this be dealt with?
I think everybody finds their own way through it. I love what one of the contributors to our book said, a young mother who lost her toddler. And she said, I don't know what I'm mad at, but I'm still mad. But people, you know, everybody feels some degree of anger. It's part of the sort of depression cycle that most people are going to feel when they lose a child. And one of our contributors, Stoffy, talks about the overwhelming anger that the parent of a lost child feels. It's not fair. It's not the natural order of things. Sometimes the child has suffered, and it's unbearable for a parent to watch. But over time, you learn to forgive not only what happened to your child, to you, but also to forgive yourself, because every parent is left with some feelings of guilt of what they wish they could have done better for their imaginary transgressions and so on. And the guilt and the anger almost seem to be tied together.
You, as two women, each of you have resolved to be able to contribute to an understanding, a depth. You're not wanting to run away from this. You've been willing to be so open about your own experiences, sharing them with other people. In doing this book, what has been the most rewarding aspect that you have experienced with it, The Grieving Garden?
Well, this is Suzanne. I'll speak for myself. I'm guessing our answers will be the same. And it's certainly coming to know all of the other 22 parents, the other 20, who were so generous in revealing intimate aspects of their own lives and revisiting times and events that were terribly painful, all for no compensation whatever except for the hope, out of the hope that they might help other parents and the people who live with and care about those other parents to better understand what they're going through. We've come to feel about them as if we are a large family.
And I think that is extremely special. And just think about how your worlds have expanded because of this experience and because of the depth of compassion you have been able to reach out to other people. You also share experiences that I thought were quite profound, and I'm going to speak of Inez again, because her baby daughter, Angelita was her name, that though she was stillborn, the fact is that there was such a connection with that baby and the rest of the family, and her daughter, Camila, that is a beautiful, beautiful girl, has a very strong connection to this child, and Angelita has often come in some way or another to them to communicate with them.
This is Sue, and I think one of my personally favorite feelings about that situation, Inez is Cuban-American, and it's part of the culture, and she brings that culture into her family. She's also, as Suzanne mentioned earlier, a practicing psychotherapist. But Angelita is is as much her child and as much a member of that family in many ways as her living children, and they all have a continuing relationship with that baby. It's quite incredible, and when you know Inez, there's nothing morbid or strange about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that's the way their family is structured.
You talk about Van Jepsen and Ian, which was the son who passed away at the age of 8. The Ian still comes to Van, still is there in the mind. There's communication. There is just an awareness that something more to life than what he's aware of, and that's very comforting to him.
It's very comforting to Van, and that's been true from the moment, or from shortly after the time that Ian died, that Van felt his presence strongly. The Van is one whose marriage fell apart because of the death of his son, but he has come to feel that he himself, Van, is much more what he calls heart-centered rather than head-centered in the way he deals with and experiences his whole life now. I've known Van personally for several years, and he's a most tender and loving and open man. I think all the men who were willing to participate in this are very unusual and special. And a lovely footnote to Van, he was recently remarried very happily.
Oh, that's fabulous. Now, both of you women have had experiences with the children that have passed on that have been mentioned in your book. They are very, very close to your heart. And Suzanne, you feel like your daughter is close to you many times, and you have conversations with her. And Susan, you have had, you know, similar experiences. I think that this is wonderful to be able to talk about this, because you're both very caring women. You have both gone through your own tragedies. But again, you've expanded so much in your perceptions about life. In many ways, your children have given you additional gifts that you never thought you would ever get.
Oh, certainly we continue to get gifts in our own growing, but I'd like to say that the book doesn't purport to say that there is communication with our children after death. We leave it up to each individual to relate their own feelings and their own religious structures and so on, and how they have changed with their experience. But in terms of the expansion, I think it's very important to say that we all have to make ourselves open to growing and determine ourselves that we will not come out of this less than we were before.
You have a quote from Khalil Gibran. It's one of my favorites, and it's on children. And this is how it reads. It was written a long time ago by Khalil. And a woman who held a babe against her bosom said, "Speak to us of children." And he said, "Your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you. And though they are with you, they belong not to you. You may give them your love, but not your thoughts, for they have their own thoughts. You may house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, even in your dreams." And there's the statement after that, "That's what I believe, that they are a gift," which they truly are. Ladies, what's your website where people can go and find out more about your wonderful book, The Grieving Garden, Living with the Death of a Child?
The website is www.thegrievinggarden.com.
Wonderful. Ladies, I compliment you for being able to discuss so openly your own personal experiences and to be able to talk to other people and to so well place and write the feelings of others that were so willing to be open as well. Congratulations, and I wish you the best with this book.
Thank you so much.
Donna.
This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break. Don't forget, if you would like to be able to give this gift of understanding and insight about the death of a child or of a loved one, The Grieving Garden is a wonderful book. It really is. Go to their website, thegrievinggarden.com. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't you go away.
Do you want to lose weight?
Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, TTAP.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's T-TAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717. TTAP.com.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Telephone lines are now open if you wanted to give me a buzz. 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Also, Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. And all you need to do is give me your first name or initial, and I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. And again, 877-876-5227, 888-815-9756. I'm an information resource, and I'm delighted to assist you on the air. That's totally free. Just know that all you have to do is pick up the telephone and call. Also, I want to remind those of you who have not done this with me before, all I need from you is your first name or initial. I don't ask anything else. Of course, I like to know where you're calling from. And then after that, you can ask me after I give you my insights, anything that you like. By the way, I'm determined to give out the shrimp scampi with linguine. I've tried since the beginning of the week and it hasn't worked. So have that pad of paper and pen handy. This is Tyler Florence's recipe, and it's really a good one. So it's real simple, real easy. And in these cooler temps, it just is just a good dish to have. Now, quick like a bunny, I want to remind those of you who are living in Northern California that I am going to be at the Wisdom Festival, which is being held at Fort Mason. And that is going to be the 17th, 18th, and 19th. Go to their website for all of the details, wisdomfestival.com. Now, I'm going to be speaking there, but there are speakers that are coming in from all over the country. There's all kinds of topics. There's some classes that are going to be going on. I mean, this is a wonderful opportunity for you and your family to come out to a beautiful area, Fort Mason, right on the water, and you can just have a great time and then wander in and out of the facility if you so desire, but there's going to be all kinds of products and services, and I'm going to be in a booth there as well, and I will be doing many consultations. So stop by, say hello. I would be delighted to meet you. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. Okay, you got that pad of paper and pen? Yes, this is the recipe. Now, what I like about this is that it's not only simple, this shrimp scampi with linguine, but actually it's pretty light. And if you're like me, you sometimes want to have meals that have got a nice flavor, but aren't going to sit heavily on your stomach. I prefer myself having, you know, the pastas, et cetera, if I'm going to have any of that, in the afternoon. But, of course, that sort of makes you relaxed and lazy. But that's me. That's how I respond when I have those kind of carbs. But anyway, It's a wonderful dish that if you want to have company and then you want to have a super-duper dessert afterwards, this is a good thing to serve. Now, this is what you're going to need. A pound of linguine, some kosher salt. You're going to need 4 tablespoons of butter. Remember, this needs to be at room temperature, 4 tablespoons of butter. 4 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil. 4 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil. 2 large shallots, and you want to dice those up finely. Now, if you don't have shallots, use regular onions, whatever works for you. 2 cloves of garlic, and you want to mince that. 2 cloves of garlic. You want a pinch of red pepper flakes, if you like it a little spicy. If you're a person that doesn't want it spicy, don't put the red pepper flakes in. Then you're going to need 1 pound of large shrimp. Of course, they need to be peeled and deveined. It's nice if you can leave the tails on, because it gives a nice look. And then you're going to need some freshly ground black pepper. You're going to need 1/2 cup of dry white wine. And remember always, if you're going to use wine in a recipe, you want to use a wine that tastes good to you. Don't use a wine you don't like the taste of. It's so important. You're going to need a lemon, and you want to have that lemon, you want to juice that lemon. And if you want to get a lot of juice out of the lemon, nuke it in the microwave for about 10 seconds, and that'll cause the membranes inside to really loosen up all the delicious lemon juice inside. Then you need 1/4 cup of freshly chopped parsley. Yes, just fresh parsley there. Chop it all up. Have all of your ingredients assembled. Don't do the assembly as you're going through the process. Put everything out. Have everything ready, because this is going to be quite fast. Now, of course, you're going to need a large pot of water. Bring it to a boil. Put in the linguine and 1 tablespoon of salt. The pasta is going to separate. I know when I was growing up, people always, because I came from an Italian background, they'd say, oh, put oil in the water. You don't need to put oil in the water. It can make a little bit of difference, but it's not necessary. So if you add the salt, the pasta will separate. You cover it. Once the pasta's been put in so that the water returns to a boil, the linguine will be done in about 6 or 8 minutes. And you don't want your pasta thoroughly, thoroughly cooked. You just want it so that it's not quite done. You want to drain, and you want to reserve 1 cup of your pasta water. After you cook the linguine, 1 cup of your pasta water. In a large skillet, and this moves fast, in a large skillet, you're going to melt 2 tablespoons of your butter and two tablespoons of olive oil over medium-high heat. You want to add your shallots or your onions, whatever you prefer, the garlic, and the red pepper if you're going to use it. And you cook it until the onion or shallots are translucent. That's going to take you about 3 or 4 minutes. Then your shrimp, you season it with a little bit of salt and pepper. You then toss them into the skillet and cook until they're pink. And that doesn't take long at all, 2 to 3 minutes, and they're ready. You remove your shrimp. You want to keep them on a warm platter. Then you add your wine and lemon juice to the skillet and bring all of the juices to a boil. Add the remaining butter and olive oil. When the butter is melted, then return the shrimp to the skillet, along with your parsley, your pasta, and reserved cooking water. You stir it all together well, season with salt and pepper a little bit more, drizzle it with a bit more olive oil, garnish with your parsley, and serve immediately. It just makes such a lovely platter. It really is. It's just so pretty. And a nice salad, crusty bread. Oh, I mean, you're not going to eat any better than that. And, of course, for dessert, what would you have? Chocolate. Good thing, yes. But I don't have a recipe for a chocolate dessert, so I'm not going to be sharing that with you today. But, of course, the holidays are going to be evolving before we know it. We're going to have lots of good recipes to share between now and then. But anyway, I wanted to give that recipe to you because it's light, it's easy, it's quick. And unless someone is not a fan of shrimp, it certainly is so healthy, and it really tastes good. So you can adapt that recipe a little bit with some of the things that you perhaps would like to adapt it with, and it's up to you. But remember, that special flavor with the butter and the olive oil, all of those flavors are so delicate, and they go along with the shrimp very nicely. So it's just really a delightfully light dish. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, 877-876-5227, Canadians, 888-815-9756, and all I need is your first name or initial, and then after that, hey, you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that you like. Well, nature has a way of constantly surprising us, And as we become so much more technologically savvy about many things, we're finding and discovering unusual items. And mammoth tusks really give a lot of history. Any kind of old bones, archaeologists really are always fascinated with what they can discover with these old bones. Now, there's a scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California. They found ancient mammoth tusks, and they said what amazed them is that within the mammoth tusks, and I've got pictures in front of me, there are pieces of metal. Now, that's sort of odd. But they think it might have come because of a meteor explosion that sent pieces of iron and nickel flying like buckshot. Isn't that a verbal visual? Well, they think this happened over Alaska. When exactly? They're not sure. They collected a number of tusks that they found near the Yukon River and also a bison skull that was found in Siberia. And when they were looking at these old bones, they found tiny iron and nickel metal fragments in them. So they're theorizing that this exploding meteor sent these flying through the air, and it got embedded into the bones of the animals that were unlucky enough to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Also, they feel that there was a huge meteor that hit an area of Allakaket in Alaska, and they say it is now a lake. However, there are scientists that are disagreeing with this. There is a scientist, Buck Sharpton, who's the vice chancellor for research at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He thinks that the iron pieces that they found embedded in the tusks have been put there because the animals were near a very iron-rich sediment that collected in cavities in the tusks. How many of us would think of a tusk having cavities? Well, they can have holes in their tusks just like we get holes in our teeth. When they were buried in the ground, when the animals died and those tusks had these little spaces because of the sediment that they were buried in, it has been determined that that's probably how it got in there. The real answer, I don't think anybody will ever know. But it's fascinating every time we are able to go a little bit further with science, to try to answer questions that we honestly don't have answers to. It causes curiosity to expand and for exploration to become a part of life and experience. And the three-letter word, why, becomes very significant, leading us to whole new areas of endeavor. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Now, tomorrow, we're going to be talking with a gentleman, Dennis P. McMahon. We're going to be talking about his development into the paranormal. His book is titled Into the Mystic. He's a fascinating man, and his story is going to take us on a journey that is going to relate specifically to his own encounters. And then on Friday, we're going to be talking desserts. Oh, yes. A guest that I've had on previously, Chef Rachel Albert-Matisse, this is a woman that absolutely has a passion for food. It is so much fun always to talk with her. But she's come out with an ice dream book. Rachel is a woman that has long been interested in nutrition, loves delicious food, and so she decided she was going to try to come up with some recipes that give us an alternative to ice cream. So this is the Ice Dream Cookbook, so we've got a lot of good things that we're going to be sharing there. So I invite you to join us, and again, have your pad of paper handy, because we are going to be sharing some really good stuff with you. It's a lot of fun. And, of course, you'll be able to find out about our website. So those are the people that are going to be coming up this week. And next week, we're going to be talking about Listening with Heart, Elizabeth Diane, pet care. Yes, Paul Mann's going to be my guest. And then the Roswell legacy, Jesse Marcel, the son of Mr. Marcel, who was on the site in Roswell and brought back artifacts. from that accident to his house that have never been seen again once the military took it. So, anyway, we've got a lot of good things to talk about. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. Meanwhile, we're taking a break, and we're going to be back in just a moment.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227, 888-815-9756. Now, so often, you'll hear statements made about how people just don't care. Well, the guests I had on earlier are two women that have gone through tragedies themselves, and in their own way, they're trying to help other people so that they can get through them. I wanted to share a story with you about a man named Jeff, and his name is Jeff Parnas. He lives in New York City, and he turned around a concern that he had because of the death of a very dear friend, his friend and also his business partner. Hagay Shefi was his partner. He had been in Tower 1 at 9/11 that very morning. He was planning on becoming an American citizen, and he died in the 9/11 incident. He had 2 children, and Jeff had so frequently, after that event occurred, that I wish I could do something. He felt very, very helpless. He didn't know what he could do. Well, one day, he happened to see some things going on television, and he said, you know, I've got to be able to do something. And he was watching his children playing, and he saw that there were a number of their toys that they weren't wanting to play with anymore, and he said that a light bulb went off in his head. There was an answer for him, a way that he could give back, a way that he could honor the friend that he had valued so much. And he said it brought back a lot of memories after the 9/11 event. And he said, I remember all of the caring that came forth after that particular event. And I remember how there was such a sense of generosity and openness. And people that had been devastated by the incident, how there were so many that wanted them to know that they were loved, that they'd be cared for, that life was going to be okay. Well, while he was watching television, there happened to be a series of disasters in California. And he thought, we got so much help from people on the other side of the U.S., California especially. He said, now it's time for us as New Yorkers to be able to do something for them. It's sort of this attitude of passing it on. So this is what he did. He told his wife, he said, I want us to tell everyone that I'm going to rent a truck. I am filling it with stuff, and I'm going to take it to California. This is a way of New York saying thank you for all of the help that the people gave. And this was for the fire victims in 2003. This was November the 5th, 2003, to November 9th, 2003, that they were wanting to help people get through. Well, the word got out. Just word of mouth alone, one person telling another. People went through their drawers. They went out to stores. They wanted to do something. And the very next morning, after he had made this announcement to his wife, 32 boxes of donations were sitting on his front porch. A friend walked up to him and said, I'm going to make a sign for your truck. People saw the sign. On the sign, it says, New York says thank you. Now, Jeff had gotten a U-Haul. They had put it on the street, and they have an outline of the United States, and California as a state and New York as a state were highlighted in a dark blue, and there was a dotted line connecting the two of them, East Coast to West Coast. That U-Haul was filled to the brim. The New Yorker said, this is our chance to give back to people who had given so much to us. Once that truck was filled, Jeff and Evan took off 5 days, and they started out for California. With the sign on their truck, everywhere they stopped, people wanted to know what they could do. A soldier in Pennsylvania gave him $4 cash. A motel manager in Arizona handed Jeff his grandmother's heirloom blanket. He said it should go to someone who needs comfort. Now, when they got into California, it was really bad. When they stepped out of the truck, the people that greeted them were just excited. Someone cared. They drove 3,000 miles to show it. They go back home. Then they hear about a tornado. Someone said, can we take the truck, get the truck filled up, and drive to where that's happening? Jeff said, I need to do this. This is really a good thing. I want my sons to know that this is a good thing to do. It's the right thing to do, no matter where emergencies happen. Now, this is what they've done. He first did this in 2003. Every year on the anniversary of 9/11, they decided they were going to help rebuild a community hit by a disaster. Tornadoes, hurricanes, fires, floods, whatever. They decided they were going to do this. And since then, the New York Says Thank You.org, that's their website, New York Says Thank You.org, has caused hundreds of people to help rebuild two small towns in Illinois, a veteran's home in Texas, a 6-year-old leukemia patient's house in Louisiana, a church in Indiana, and a lot more. And what has been happening, the people that have been helped by Jeff, they have joined his project so they can help somebody else. They want to pass it on. They want to pay it forward. Now, this year, they had a project of a barn raising, an old-fashioned barn raising, to rebuild county fairgrounds in Greensburg, Kansas, that was hit by a tornado last May. He said, it's not really about 9/11 anymore. It's about the humanity people showed one another after that event. From that day on, terror, well, out of that terror has come something else, kindness and a willingness to pass it on. I thought that was a great story to share, and I wanted to end the hour with that. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. You're the one that makes up your mind about how you want to live your life. And you know, when you make a choice, like Jeff did, there are always going to be plenty of people there to support you, because they're going to say, I want to help you, because I want to pass it on too. Jeff is creating legacy, and we can all do it, each in our own way. Donna Sebo here. Remember, it is your job to be true to yourself, and in being true to yourself, wow, you're going to give a lot to life in the process. See you same time, same place, right here at bbsradio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.